Now, what you are about to hear are some of the great moments of sports history.
Gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to the 500 level. Opinions, news, and views on Toronto sports from the upper deck. Leafs, Raptors, Jays, Argos, TFC, nothing is off limits. It's good to be a fan. Your hosts, Amin and Ben.
Okay, welcome to another edition of 500 level podcast. Ben, we got Ben and Amin, of course, the anticipated return of Patrice. He's a guest on the show today. Welcome, Patrice. How are you doing?
Not bad. Thanks for having me, guys.
No problem. Glad to have you back on. Ben, you doing well?
Yeah, I'm doing great. I just wanted to throw out the welcome back Cotter theme song. Do we have does the DJ have that queued up somewhere? We'll have to find that for him.
Welcome back. Your dreams were your ticket out. Welcome back to that same old place that you laughed about.
Yeah, welcome back, definitely. Let's get, there's a lot of stuff to talk about. I mean, of course, the three of us on the show, it might take a bit longer to get through some of the topics we have on the table, but in our little round table, we're going to start off with the NHL situation with the Leafs in particular. Of course, a lot of changes happened, and the big, collapse, you can talk about epic collapse from being in the eighth spot and 4 points away from the fourth spot and making the playoffs now to being playing for a lottery pick almost, and they're calling it Tank Nation. This is quite the turnaround. What are your thoughts on what's going on with the Leafs right now?
Go ahead, Patrice. I'll let you have the floor first.
Well, I mean, I feel kind of bad for the Leafs coaching staff and the fans in general because, you know, they were basically, they bought fool's gold. You know, Wilson's basketball style of hockey, which, you know, in defending was entirely optional, was bound to come back to haunt the Leafs at some point, and was never going to make it, going to work if they'd even made the playoffs anyways. You know, you look at the roster on the Leafs, they're just not a talented team. And more importantly than not being a talented team, it's a team that completely lacks leadership. You know, the whatever the leadership group in the Leafs is, there's no one there who you can look at and say, this guy is going to stand up in the room and say, you know what, this isn't acceptable. We have to do this, 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 and this. You know, it's a young team, and so, but it's got no one who's really experienced in winning.
When your best exactly player, right. Is even if it wasn't the winning thing, every veteran that they've brought in to be leaders, whether it's Phaneuf or Kessel or Grabowski, none of those guys are vocal leaders. And now with the new coaching staff, all they mention is the truculence. We need to be—they need to be aggressive and do everything defensively. And it's a total wrong style and wrong system for all these players. And you know, Burke should have been smarter. I know he had the history with Carlisle, but it's a lot easier to change one guy than 24. You know, Carlisle's going to want to turn around the roster. Is this another 5-year rebuilding process for the Leafs?
Yeah, it's There's a lot of questions around this team right now, and when it came to choosing a new coach, I was personally selecting Eakins. I've covered the Marlies before. I've seen Eakins up front and seen the transformation that these young players that he's dealing with to come up and play for the NHL. They're NHL ready by the time they're playing for the Marlies for a few weeks, and you can see that with all the young players that have been called up. So I'm agreeing there that maybe Carlisle may not have been right for this team in particular, and you're going to see a lot of changes in the offseason to kind of get that truculence that Burke first brought to talked about when he came to the team, when he first got here. That's the kind of play he always liked and he had in Anaheim, and of course he was there with Carlisle, so he's looking to bring that back. But it was earlier this year that he sent down one of the enforcers. I can't remember, Jay Rosehill, or is it somebody else? I can't remember the name of the player, but he sent him down, made a huge deal in the press conference that these guys have no place in the game anymore. It's a shame. And then here he is bringing back Carlisle. This is the kind of style of hockey they want to play again, which is not right for this team. So You know, there's a lot of things going on here that, you know, like you said, Patrice, you know, it's easier to change one guy than 24 guys, and it is a lot of players who do not mesh with Carlisle. And if you talk about the leadership and talent on this team, you're right. I mean, I wouldn't say they're completely talentless. You got some players who are talented. You got Lupul coming out of nowhere who's injured right now. You got Kessel who's talented, maybe not a leader. Now there's Lupul, and Grabowski stepped it up this year again. But Phaneuf as your captain, I've never liked Phaneuf as a captain, and I'm barely a fan of him as a player. So, I mean, what Burke has been able to do so far has been a fail in my eyes.
Here's the issue, though. You have truculence in the team. You have guys who want to play with that. You have the Mike Browns. You have the Colby Armstrongs. You have those guys. But those guys aren't going to lead the Leafs anywhere than they haven't already been. You know, hovering between like 8th and the bottom of the conference. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if that's the way Burke wants to go, then, you know, he needs to be upfront and say, you know what, this is not going to be a successful team. If they want to go with the youth movement, I mean, you look at guys like Kadri, who, you know, they give a couple of games to and then discard him to the Marlies, while senior players are playing worse than him and never get sent anywhere. Like, what does that say to the young guys anyways? We basically have no shot. And once again, all the talent, the youth, they go other places, and they go other places and they shine. Like, the Leafs have to decide once and for all what they're going to do. Are they going to build with the farm system, the talent that supposedly is in their system, and give those guys a chance to play and accept the growing pains? If they're going to do that, then do that and bring in a coach who will relate to them. But don't bring in a coach like Carlisle, who in his first three practices, you know, wants to skate guys into the ground, and, you know, the stars are complaining about it. You have guys like Kessel saying, this isn't what I signed up for. You know, he's going to alienate the room, and they're just going to keep going, and it's just going to be musical coaches, and the Leafs are never going to get anywhere. Even the bottom teams in the East, the Islanders, you see actual light at the end of the tunnel, and they were like a joke from the front office to the ice. But you see where they're going because they have a plan. It just doesn't seem like the Leafs have any sort of plan as to what they want to do.
No, I agree with that. I mean, Burke is saying he wants to do the right way. Then he trades away draft picks for players, and then, you know, he's trying to get into the playoffs all of a sudden. So, I mean, there's a lot we could talk about this ad nauseum. But basically, this team is basically a mess right now, and there's a lot of questions.
First part of the season, they had a bunch of scoring. You know, at least they had that. You had Grabowski scoring a lot of goals. You had Kessel scoring a lot of goals.
Lupul. You know,
and that was because, obviously, they weren't playing defense, and they could lose a game 6-5, and it wouldn't matter. And Carlisle comes in, and now he's playing this whole defensive system. They've won only two of the last, whatever, 16 or 17 games. And they got shut out a couple times in a row. Like, where did the scoring go? Are they focusing that much on playing defense that they can't score anymore?
That's it. Bingo. That's what it is. It's basically Carlisle is making sure that the defensemen are not abandoning the front of the net, which they were prone to do. And when you got goalies like Reimer and Gustafsson not able to stop the puck and letting in bad goals, you have no option but to keep playing a defensive style because your goalies will not bail you out. If so, Leafs had good goalies...
I am the first to throw Reimer and Gustafsson under the bus, but the fact of the matter is, with almost the exact same defense, Reimer led almost a resurgence. He did not become bad. He had a concussion, yeah. Maybe he isn't as confident as he is. But really, the Leafs were playing glorified shinny. They weren't playing any sort of system. No goalie, even an elite-level goalie, would have been able to put up any sort of, you know, decent numbers when they're being left with odd man rushes time after time after time simply because Wilson didn't care if his goalie stopped the puck. He just wanted to outscore the opposition. Like, you need to look at this. You need to look at this realistically. Gustafsson and Reimer didn't all of a sudden become somewhat decent goalies because their defensemen happened to skate back into their own zone. They actually have confidence that they're not going to be left 3-on-1, 4-on-1, like 3/4 of the game.
I don't know. I mean, it's a combination of both. Reimer is not the same goalie he was last year. And you're right, the defense is somewhat similar to the have. Now, Wilson, I never liked Wilson as a coach either. His systems didn't work either with this team for whatever reason. But I do think that this year, the better goalie has been Gustafsson, and Reimer has just, for whatever reason, the bad start. I mean, Wilson was yanking goalies, frequently, and changing the goalies around, that the goalies never really had a chance to build any confidence because you never knew who's going to start next, which is doesn't do anything for you if you're trying to come into a game and try to get back on your game and be confident goalie. So, I mean, I don't think Wilson handled the whole goaltender situation very well. And, of course, his defense was horrible on the team. So there's a number of things there.
Well, there is one good story, not in Toronto, but in the NHL, and that comes out of Pittsburgh, where we hear the concussed Sidney Crosby has overcome his symptoms and is going to make his return to the ice on Thursday versus the Rangers. Last time he made his return against the Islanders, and I think he had 3 or 4 points that night. This time a little bit more difficult of a challenge, but still in the New York area, obviously a big media hub. There's going to be a lot of people at that game, a lot of eyes on Crosby. He says that he's not just in it for 2 or 3 games and then going to be out again. This is for good this time. He's going to be back. What do we think? Can Crosby stay the rest of the season? Does this make the Penguins Stanley Cup favorites again?
I'm really worried about Sidney Crosby because, you know what? Let's call it what it is. You can call it a concussion, but that's just a nice way of saying brain damage. And, you know, I'm actually seeing like an Eric Lindros-like future for him. Eventually, he's going to get hit coming across the middle. It might not be in his first game, but it is going to happen. He's going to get his bell rung, and unfortunately, he's going to end up like Mark Savard. That's the bottom line. He's not going to be the same player that he was. The old Sidney Crosby, while, you know, staying away from the physical stuff, had no fear of going into the corners and did a lot of decent stuff in the corners. But, you know, is he going to be the same guy? Because in the back of his mind, he must know that he's 1 or 2 hits away from being in a dark room for a very long time. I'm actually really worried about him.
I agree with being worried. It's not quite clear if the last time he was kept out of the lineup that was a clear concussion or not. It was neck issues, but I do think if he does get hit one more time in this comeback attempt, then, you know, his rest of his career is in jeopardy. And this is a difference between coming back in November and coming back in mid-March when, I mean, that's the beginning of the, you know, not even midway point of the season. Teams are still feeling each other out. The intensity is not there. But now people are jostling for playoff positions, trying to make the playoffs. These games mean a hell of a lot more than they did before. And for that reason, Crosby will not be taken lightly. They're going to be hitting him. And they may not be doing it deliberately, but they'll be hitting him. And this is a different... There's a debate going on whether he should potentially be making this comeback now or just come back at the beginning of next year when, you know, people will be taking it a little lighter on him and the games are not as intense. And, you know, the Penguins have won 9 in a row. Malkin's on MVP kind of year, leading the league in the NHL in points. So do the Penguins even need him back is the other question.
Well, I don't think having Crosby in the lineup hurts your team in any way except for, you know, maybe the media circus around it, because, you know, in Toronto we always blame the media for the team's poor performance, so maybe the Penguins can do that if they if he comes back, they get some attention, and then the team suffers.
No, Penguins aren't whining like the Leafs are, so.
And besides, the Penguins are accustomed to this. They went through it with his last comeback, you know. Like Hammond says, you know, Sidney Crosby is not going to make them any more favorites for the Cup anyways. I mean, Malkin is playing out of his mind. And quite frankly, in my opinion, the favorites for the Cup are the team that holds the Cup right now, the Bruins.
I
don't think they've been the same since the Tim Thomas thing. And Marty Turco isn't exactly a solid backup if they need him at any point in the playoffs.
He can't actually play the playoffs. He actually is filling in for Tuukka Rask. He signed a contract too late, so.
And even if he couldn't play in the playoffs, you know, Marty Turco is a little flaky. I mean, I'm not going to say anything too bad about Marty. You know, I have two same reconnections myself. But, you know, he's carried teams, not great teams. The Dallas teams that he carried deep in the playoffs weren't the greatest. But, you know, he has a playoff experience. I trust Turco more than I trust Rask because nobody knows what Rask would do in the playoffs.
Yeah, well, right now Thomas is still the guy. So as long as Thomas is, still playing, decent. I mean, the team is right now, when you've won the cup and you're kind of, you know, you're making the playoffs, sometimes it gets tough to kind of get motivated. I think when the playoffs start, you're right, Patrice, Bruins are a team to watch out for. I mean, they went on a tear back in November and December, and one of the best teams in the league. They've tailed off since then, but there's a lot of other teams to keep an eye out. And getting back to the Penguins for right now, I mean, Crosby, if he's able to play like he had during that stretch before he got knocked out again, I mean, the Penguins will be all that much more better.
And I totally understand that, but you know that come the playoffs, if it comes down to the Bruins having a chance to defend their cup and against the Penguins, well, based on last year against the Canucks, the Bruins have no problem taking a little extra liberties with people they consider threats. So, you know, and Bylsma and the Penguins will not be able to protect Crosby against the Bruins. So, I mean, and when you have a guy like Chara coming down to steamroll you in the corner, if I'm Sidney Crosby, I don't think I'm actually going in the corner with the same vigor that, you know, a healthy Sidney Crosby would.
Agreed. Definitely going to change his playing style for sure. Let's move on to some talking about the Jays and, of course, spring training. The Jays have already played quite a few games. Looking at their schedule, already 10-2-1. They're off to a hot start in spring training so far. So not a lot of big stories to talk about with the Jays. Of course, Omar Vizquel is really impressing the team right now, playing at third base, making a numerous, you know, great plays. And so he's catching the eye. But in your opinion, guys, what are some stories that you're keeping an eye on for spring training?
Well, I think it's basically just the pitching staff. You know, they have kind of 1, 2, 3 sorted out. We kind of figure we know who 4 and 5 are, but there's a lot of talk now of Anthopoulos being in the market to shore up his rotation. So, you know, going out there and trying to get someone like Joe Blanton, or there's a couple other names being, you know, thrown around. So, but nothing too severe, and I, you know, no one really knows if anything's going to happen. I don't think anything will, but, you know, if I had to put my money on it, I'm saying nothing's happening. But, you know, what they have now is they look okay, and it's just a matter of keeping things together and keeping people uninjured and, you know, coming back to Toronto healthy.
You know, I agree with a lot of what Ben says. You know, I've always believed, I mean, the Jays pitching staff isn't bad. It's just they suffer being in the American League East. But you know, I've always think if they could get the middle relievers to get that squared away, I think there's a lot of games where it was the middle relievers that lost the game for the Jays, not the starters, and obviously not the closers, because they really didn't. I mean, the closers weren't that great last year, if memory serves me correctly. Anyways, but I really think they need it's about the pitching. They need to worry about the middle relief more than anything else.
Well, their relief is, I mean, the bullpen's looking pretty strong this year. That's probably one of the strongest aspects of the team. I think, Ben, you've mentioned that numerous times, no?
Yeah, when you look down at who they have in the bullpen this year, the back end is a lot stronger this year with the acquisition of Santos as the closer. You have the veteran in Darren Oliver now, who's going to be the left-handed specialist. You have Jason Frazier, who returns after his, 3-week hiatus from the Jays or something like that. You still have Cordero, Jansen when he's healthy, Lich when he's healthy, Villanueva, Luis Perez. You know, you could end up with a guy like McGowan in the bullpen, depending on how the starter things, the rotation breaks out. So I think they're pretty solid there. It's just going to be the matter of, you know, you get a guy like Kyle Drabek, who basically has no chance of making the roster this year, and they don't even see, you know, they're not even sure what his future holds now, because they're totally retooling his delivery. This is a guy they expected to be, you know, an ace of the staff. Or at least, you know, a 1 or 2 starter come this year or next year. And, you know, now we're not ever sure where we're going to see Kyle Drabek again. So, you know, Anthopoulos just has to watch. He can fall into the same trap as Burke does and keep, you know, extending the 5-year plan until now it's a 10-year plan and all our young stars are now gone again.
Yeah, no, very good points, Ben. You know, to me, a lot of stuff to be, you know, to think about. And of course, when the season starts, you know, how this team comes together is going to be very interesting to see. Any other thoughts, Patrice?
I'm pretty much in agreement. You know, I'm at this point taking a wait-and-see approach with the Jays. You know, I've just been disappointed too many times. Although, with the addition of the extra playoff spots, I'm hoping we'll get to see some postseason baseball in Toronto.
Sounds good.
Crossing our fingers. And Patrice, I'm taking you to an A's game no matter what you say.
I don't know about that. I'm waiting for the Mets to arrive in the crossover game.
There you go.
The Mets, okay. Well, I'll keep an eye out for that one. Let's talk about the Raptors, of course. A lot of stuff that, you know, potentially could be changing with the trade deadline coming up. And, of course, this team is not all that far back from the playoffs. It was actually on CFRB, interviewed for Sports Talk with Mike Toth, aired on the weekend. And I kind of gave my thoughts on the Raptors and a lot of stuff that Ben and I have talked about in past podcasts. But one thing I thought is, you know, with Andrea Bargnani back, and although Calderon got hurt the same game that he returned, and he's only day-to-day, if both these players are, you know, healthy in the lineup and this team can go on a win streak, they can potentially make the playoffs. They're only 4.5-5 games back of Milwaukee and the Knicks. So is the team going to start tanking, you think? Or is this team going to be, you know, potentially making it a run to the playoffs, which no one thought was possible? Definitely come over next year.
So, you know, to get a high lottery pick, I think, quite frankly, is more important than an extra two home games. Oh, I totally agree.
But the thing is, if you're in that Raptors locker room, I mean, you're going out there playing with pride. You want to win every night. So knowing that everyone can agree here that the lottery pick is the best course of action for the Raptors in the future. But if you're in that locker room and you're playing your heart out every single night and you want to win, looking at Andrea Bargnani, if he can play back to the all-star numbers he had before he got hurt, Calderon starts, you know, playing as well as he has all season long, and the rest of the team, which is coming up just short in so many games against some of the better teams in the NBA, this team will win some games. And it's kind of concerning me that they will make the playoffs.
That they get a lottery pick is Calderon gets shut down for the year. Bargnani, he just magically tweaks his hamstring again. They shut him down for the year. You have a lottery pick. That's how you do it. You don't ask the players to tank. You just sit them out the rest of the year. You play with the, you know, what talent you have left. But, you know, shut those two guys down for the rest of the year and see them fall away from that eighth spot pretty fast.
Well, the precedence is there. That's what Bosh did is when he left.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I preferably obviously want to see the lottery pick, but I'm kind of scared seeing that this team could go on a win streak here and move up in the standings, which will hurt their lottery chances.
Well,
so
at the end of the day, I'm not relying on the Raptors. The Raptors are going to play hard. This case is going to make them play hard. To me, I'm relying on Milwaukee to do enough to maintain eighth.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to come in with breaking news. Dun-dun-dun, dun-dun-dun. Tonight in the NBA, before the end of the trade deadline tomorrow, a trade between the Milwaukee Bucks and the Golden State Warriors
The Bucks have acquired Monte Ellis and Steven Jackson for Andrew Bogut. It definitely helps the Bucks and could have them really fighting can secure that eighth playoff spot away from the Knicks, because the Knicks are now terrible. So
yeah, it was Kwame Brown part of that trade too? That's what I've been reading too.
Yeah, he was. Yep.
And Elk wow. Was it Ekpe Udoh? I don't know who these players are, but I've heard of Kwame before. But
and there was a protected number one draft pick thrown in there too. But
I mean the Bucks have got the scoring they need to easily. Salt away eighth. That's the bottom line. I mean, you know, Monte Ellis can. I mean, all he can do is score. You're not gonna get much D out of him. Although, playing in Milwaukee for Skiles, he'll probably have to play D or else he won't play. You know, that's a big trade. But it all depends for Golden State. It all depends on if Bowie comes back to how he was before he got hurt. He's the key to that trade. And Steven Jackson is Steven Jackson. He's a cancer no matter where he ends up.
Yeah. He was on that team.
For quickly plummeting fantasy basketball team.
Well, breaking news, and we're just talking about the Bucks. So that's great for the Bucks, and you know, I'd like to see him pull away and get into the playoffs. And of course, you have the Knicks there too, with Lin's sanity, which died down incredibly fast. So I'm hoping the Raptors again.
Play against teams that will defend you.
Yeah, exactly. Not like the Raptors and some other teams. So now... Go ahead, Ben.
I was going to say, I guess there was one trade that didn't happen. It wasn't supposed to happen this year. It was supposed to happen way back when, I guess probably about 96, 97, at the height of Vinsanity in Toronto. Never mind Linsanity. There was apparently... Glenn Grunwald apparently turned down Vince Carter and Antonio Davis for Dirk Nowitzki and Nash and Steve Nash. So that was apparently on the table, and it was Grunwald who turned it down way back when. So this was, we have to remember, this was the height of Vince, all-star. They had just won their playoff series, or they were going to win it that year, I think it was. Antonio Davis was still a force. Dirk and Nash were not the all-star MVP caliber players they are now and have been. Was it, can we blame Grunwald for turning that down at the time?
Absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not. If he had made that trade, he would have been crucified. He would have been hung from their Canada Center or wherever they were playing at that point. I mean, Vince was one of the, maybe you could argue one of the top five players in the league at that point. And Antonio Davis was a rock for the Raptors. And quite frankly, there is no guarantee that Dirk Nowitzki or Steve Nash would end up being as good as they are now if they were playing in Toronto. Especially not Steve Nash, who has the pressure of an entire country on his shoulders.
Yeah.
I agree with Patrice there. I mean, Carter put Raptors on the map in the NBA. They were laughable up until, you know, he came out and, you know, played so well. And, of course, that dunk-off, I mean... what he did there just definitely put him in the forefront, and it's probably what kind of attracted the trade attention for that one trade and other trades potentially. But at that time, who could have foresaw Carter going down the way he did and leaving the town the way he did, you know, faking injuries and being whiny? You didn't see that from him at that time. So you can't look into the crystal ball and look forward and foreseeing that happen at that time. So I can't blame him at all.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. Vince Carter electrified basketball in Toronto. And I think, Grunwald would have been run out of town with pitchforks if he had made that deal at the time. And, you know, people still wear the throwback dinosaur jerseys with Carter because of that dunk-off. Mm-hmm. So there's no other player in Toronto history, basketball history, that's ever done that. So,
Talking about other trade deadline stuff, Ben, what are you potentially foreseeing in your crystal ball happening trade deadline?
Well, I don't think much is going to happen. There's obviously Dwight Howard is the big piece. Everyone is thinking that he'll move somewhere, and if he moves anywhere, you know, that'll start maybe some dominoes. But the way the Magic are playing, I think they're going to end up keeping him. Try and build around, you know, try and bring someone in the offseason to play with him and keep him here. He's already said he doesn't want to play in Chicago, which doesn't make any sense to me. And then, you know, you always have the Lakers are trying to improve to stay relevant. They're talking about moving either Gasol or Bynum. Those are the rumors floating around, but I don't know why the Lakers would want to move either one of those pieces, really. That's a core that I wouldn't really want to break up. But I don't know, I haven't really heard anything else. But Patrice, any other rumors on the street?
No, I haven't heard anything else, but, you know, I mean, I don't know why Dwight Howard doesn't want to play in Chicago, but, I mean, maybe he's just not into playing on title contending teams. Because,
yeah.
Granted, you know, if, as a Bulls fan, if they gave up Carlos Boozer, I would be ecstatic because you know, he's horrible.
No problems with that move, eh?
No, if they want Howard for Boozer and, you know, anyone who's not named Noah or Luol Deng, that's fine.
I would have to
be frozen and get moved. As to the Lakers, you know, people are short memories. I mean, they must not remember when Kobe was ready to sign with the Clippers because he was so tired of getting swept by Phoenix in the first round of the playoffs. If Pau Gasol never came to the Lakers, Andrew Bynum would not be as good as he was because Pau Gasol allows Bynum to do really all he can do. Shoot jump hooks and rebound.
Yeah, they're a title team. Gasol is probably one of the best low post players. He's got a full, well-rounded game. And, you know, just because they pissed him off earlier in the season and tried to trade him then, doesn't mean they should trade him now. They're a contender with Gasol and Bynum. If they move any one of those two guys, they're out in the first round.
Oh, yeah. If they move any one of those first guys, the Lakers automatically become irrelevant in Los Angeles, and the Clippers will rise to dominance.
Exactly.
Yeah, which, you know, is going to be happening in the next couple of years. You can foresee that for sure.
I'm not too sure about that. You know, Chris Paul is a fantastic player, but people need to realize, you know, and Lob City is a great name and all this sort of stuff, but Lob City is not working in the playoffs, and you still have the problem that Blake Griffin cannot do anything offensively that does not involve dunking a basketball.
He can't hit free throws where his life depended on it.
He can't hit free throws. DeAndre Jordan will block everything, but in the playoffs, guys are just going to come after him, let him block six of the shots, and watch him sit on the bench for the rest of the game. And quite frankly, the bench of the Clippers is very underwhelming.
Okay, I'll take your word. I haven't watched too much of the Clippers play this year, but I just heard good things, so I haven't heard anything about the stuff you said there, so I'll take your word for that one. But let's move on to talk about TFC. We, you know, obviously last week was the big game at Rogers Center. It had, 48,000 people there. Amazing atmosphere. I was there covering the game, and it was just phenomenal. See, I haven't seen an event like that in Toronto for a long time, of course, and especially in that building, probably since the Jays in the playoffs. So great to see all the fans come together and support the Reds, even though the team has been horrible in MLS. But, you know, they fought well against LA. And, of course, tomorrow you got the second leg coming up in LA, which can be a much smaller crowd due to their noise regulations. Only 7,500 fans are going to be cheering the Galaxy on. Just what are your thoughts on the second leg?
Well, the Galaxy are lucky to still be in the tie, in my opinion, because, you know, it's the same old TFC letting in late goals, but, you know, the Galaxy did a lot of good stuff, but they didn't put the ball in the back of the net. And, you know, if you want to look at chances, TFC had more clear-cut chances to score. TFC could have scored two or three more goals easily. That being said, the Galaxy lost. The worst that could have happened for TFC was the Galaxy losing their first game, because now they're coming in with their focus as it'll be razor sharp. And, you know, I don't really think the Galaxy needs 7,500 or, you know, 20,000 fans to know what is at stake here. I actually foresee probably a 2-0 or 3-0 victory for the Galaxy.
Ben, your thoughts?
Yeah, they got up for it. They played well at home. They had some good energy early, TFC in Toronto. They got up the goals, but then, like what you mentioned, in classic TFC style, they let up late goals, and, you know, those away goals are going to help the Galaxy on aggregate win this. There's no way that the TFC can, I don't think, repeat their effort in L.A. Unfortunately, L.A. is just too talented of a team, and it's too early in the season for this new TFC squad to really gel it and keep up the pace against Donovan
I kind of agree with you, but somewhat different reasons, though. I think, obviously, TFC had a big lift from the fans, and that's why they had the great start they did. The other thing is the pitch, I think, had a big part of the what happened in the match. It was horrible. I was standing on it the day before. You could see the seams clearly from up above. This was one. I think the MLS commissioner was there, and he said the exact same thing. If we're going to have an event like this again, we need to have a better pitch because it looked brutal. He said that some of the players, when they were dribbling awkwardly when they hit those seams. So that definitely, I think, really threw off the Galaxy, who are not used to playing on that kind of a turf. And TFC different because they practice on a sort of similar kind of turf at Cherry Beach. So I think that was a big factor in the early going. And you could see throughout the game that the Galaxy were coming on and may not have the same quality chances that TFC had early on. Patrice mentioned that, you know, that TFC had better chances, but you could see that they were coming on and that they're going to score that goal. And that's exactly what happened. And going back to LA, I agree with you guys, but I think playing on that on their home turf, literally the turf, will have a big factor. And yeah, you're right. They are a better team. So I think it's going to be a little closer. Maybe not. Either it's going to be 1-0 or 2-1. It's going to be a closely contested game. I think Vinter might play a more defensive style if he can.
Well, if Vince is going to play a more defensive style, he needs to have an actual defensive midfielder, because I did not know what exactly Terry Dunfield's role in that game was, other than to support the Galaxy attacks, because he seemed to be giving them the ball with alarming regularity. Like, that game cried out for, and I cannot believe I'm saying this, Julian de Guzman.
Yeah.
Like, and that is a scary thought. Like, well, that there's so little, I mean, the designated players and all that, maybe they need to get their center backs in so they can play Frings as their holding midfielder. Because, you know what, there's a very serious problem in the midfield that cannot keep retention of the ball.
Well, de Guzman will be back because his suspension is done. It's a one-game suspension, so he'll be back. I firmly believe he'll be in the starting lineup. As for Frings, he was playing the holding midfielder towards the end of the game as the Reds were trying to hold on to the lead, but as you can see, it didn't really help because set pieces is what's really the weakness for TFC. So let's move on and talk about the next topic. We got, you know, the start of NFL free agency. Ben, of course, you're a usual NFL expert on this podcast. I'm not sure, Patrice, you're an expert on NFL or not, but the frenzy has started. Some players have signed elsewhere. And of course, you know, you have Manning making his, you know, his tour with some teams. What are your thoughts, Ben, on the overall free agent status so far?
Well, I'll start with some good news for the fans of the Toronto Bills, like my friend Patrice here. apparently, there's some wild internet speculation that Texans defensive end Mario Williams and Robert Meacham are both in Buffalo today, and the news is that within the next 24 hours they will both be signing with the Buffalo Bills, which is great news for Bills fans. Mario Williams will definitely help that that defense. That defensive line is going to be a monster going into next season if this in fact happens. You'll have Kyle Williams, Mario Williams, and Marcel Darius as your D-line. That's up there with the best in the league, without a doubt. And if anyone has shown us that you need to rush the passer to be good, it's the world champion New York Football Giants. So that's a good start for them. And adding another wide receiver for Fitzpatrick doesn't help at all. With Stevie Johnson re-signing there, bringing Meacham in would be an upgrade to that core. So that's a good start. But yeah, I think the biggest free agent things are the wide receivers. There's all kinds of wide receivers signing everywhere. But if you're a free agent wide receiver, wouldn't you wait to see where Peyton Manning is signing? Don't you want to play with one of the best quarterbacks of all time?
I know I do. I know I do, because I am waiting. I'm letting my agent feel all the calls until Peyton Manning goes. When he signs on the dotted line, I'm instructing my agent, even if I have to take a little bit of a pay cut, I'm not talking anything substantial here, I am telling my agent to instruct to set up so that I am signing with Peyton Manning.
I think it would be awesome to play with Manning. There's not many players that can say they caught the ball from the best player ever. Like,
Let's take a step back.
Okay, one of the best players ever. One of the best quarterbacks ever. You can throw that out for you. But, like, you know, and also I guess the other one is Robert Griffin III. There's apparently two wide receivers that think he's going to be the top dog. Both Josh Morgan, formerly of the 49ers, and Pierre Garçon, formerly of the Colts, who played with Manning, have signed with the Redskins to play with Robert Griffin III, assuming he gets drafted by the Redskins at number two.
Wow. That's interesting.
Arjeep, I as an NFL fan cannot wait for Robert Griffin to come into the league. Like, right now, obviously, Peyton Manning, polished, poised, everything you want in a quarterback. But Robert Griffin III could be the new breed of quarterbacks. Him, Cam Newton, these guys who are just athletes who can do anything you want an offensive football player to do. These guys are the new breed of quarterback. And you know what? It's
going to
be scary watching these guys.
Yeah, the game is just so fast. The quarterbacks have to be that way now. You can't be a five-step drop back immobile quarterback. It's not going to do you any good.
Jay Cutler.
Yeah. Well, if you're a Bears fan, they just signed Jason Campbell today. I don't know if that makes you happy or not.
Well, you know, some watching the games last year.
Marshall, so there you go.
That makes you happy.
That does, I guess.
Cutler's got a big arm and likes to throw the length of the field, and Marshall will go get that ball.
Yeah, and I guess if you're a Josh Freeman fan with the Bucks, who is one of those athletic young quarterbacks, he gets the guy to throw the ball to in Vincent Jackson. So there's a lot of movement, a lot of stuff is happening in the NFL, and you know, people were worried, oh, free agency starts the same day as the March Madness tournament. Really? Apparently the NFL is still big enough to make some news.
Well, I mean, all this is telling me is that the NFL that involves a running back is getting consigned to the scrappy. I mean, you're going to see a lot of college style, you know, gimmicky offenses, the spread, and all this sort of stuff. Urban Meyer is sitting in the offices in Ohio, because as a Michigan fan, I won't call it anything more than Ohio or that university in the north, rubbing his hands with glee watching NFL games. He's probably going to be watching something. Hey, I'm going to bring that to the practice field.
Yep, there's going to be a lot of offense, and everyone thought fantasy stats blew up this past year. You just wait till next year.
Yeah, the game is certainly changing, so definitely, you know, quite the exciting season to watch. Now, of course, talking about exciting, March Madness, as you mentioned, Ben, is going to be starting off this week, and of course, you know, there's a lot of debate going on how the seeding worked on Selection Sunday. Ben, your thoughts on the number one seeds?
Well, I think the four number one seeds were pretty clear cut. It was, you know, going into it, all four, you know, they were more fighting, I guess, for the number one overall seed than anything else, than to see who the four number ones were going to be. And then they all went out and, well, I guess except for Michigan State, went out and lost their conference tournaments. So, you know, they all ended on the season on a sour note before the tournament. But I don't think anyone can really argue with Kentucky, Syracuse, North Carolina, Michigan State as the top four seeds.
Really? Really? I think you can make a very, very reasoned argument that Missouri, as the Big 12 champions, should be there over a team like Carolina, which lost in its which not only lost in its conference tournament, but had some horrendous losses throughout the season. 33 points to Florida State, losing to UNLV, those are horrendous losses. I think you could have made a serious argument that Carolina did not deserve to be a number one seed. I mean, are they talented, talent-wise, one of the best teams in the country? Of course they are. But their record doesn't state that.
And, yeah, but I don't know if Missouri, playing in the Big 12 isn't the same as playing in the ACC. I know North Carolina had a couple losses, but the ACC is still some better competition overall. And Missouri is definitely one of my, you know, my teams going through the brackets that I'm picking to go pretty far. But I don't know if, you know, being a number two in the West is, I don't think any worse for them than being the number one in the Midwest.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying, like, Syracuse and Kentucky were locked in as the two number ones. problem with Michigan State either. Michigan State won the Big Ten, which, in my opinion, was probably the best conference of college basketball this year. And they beat Ohio State twice to do it. And they beat Michigan, and they throttled Michigan, who was the third best team in the Big Ten. So I could live with that. You know, it's just that fourth number one seed, you know. To me, you should. I always like to give credence to the teams that are winning. And Missouri, except for that little blip in that Kansas game, which, you know, is being lauded as an ESPN instant classic, you know, they did everything that they were told to do, you know, in the Big 12. And, I mean, the teams they lost in the Big 12, Kansas State, Iowa State, there's no bad losses in conference for Missouri. I mean, granted, you could argue they didn't play anybody out of conference, but, you know, I guess it depends on how much emphasis you put on games in November as opposed to games in, you know, late February, March.
So we had President Obama pick his Final Four, hit the interwebs today, and he has Ohio State, Carolina, Mizzou, and Kentucky in the Final Four. Patrice Allman, how do your Final Four look, or who does your champion look like at least?
I'll let you go start off first, Patrice.
Well, I mean, I'm a Syracuse fan through and through, so up to somewhere around 2 o'clock this afternoon, Ohio State wasn't there. My Final Four was Syracuse, Carolina, Kentucky, and I believe it was Kansas. It was Michigan State. So it was Syracuse. I think I had all four number ones just because of the brackets, the way the brackets set up.
Going chalk, nice job.
Well, you know, I mean, you look at it, and Kentucky has probably, in my opinion, one of the easier roads to the Final Four, as does Carolina, whose only, you know, difficult game will be assuming they play Kansas in the regional final.
Yeah.
You know, Ohio State I had losing to Syracuse, so they obviously weren't coming up because at the end of the day, Syracuse's zone is one of the best in the country. You know, Ohio State can't shoot from the outside. So that's where I mean, assuming that Syracuse got past Vanderbilt, that was like their set for the Final Four. And what am I looking at? That's East.
So Michigan State, Kentucky.
And I mean, obviously, you know, Sparty has a couple of hard games, but, you know, they look to be the class of the Midwest. So, you know, this year, it's always going to be upsets along the way, but, you know, I just don't really see a VCU or a team like that. You know, I don't really see, like, a Cinderella making a
George
run.
Mason making a run. Yeah, my Final Four, pretty similar. I think we go Kentucky, Syracuse, like you said, up until about 2 o'clock this afternoon. I take Kansas in the Midwest, and I'll go Missouri in the West. So a couple number twos in there. Again, out of these, there's a lot of teams that I think could do, could do some smaller teams that could do some damage, but I don't see any of them going to the Final Four.
I'm going to trust you guys' opinion on this. I don't really watch much college basketball, so when it comes to March Madness every year, I kind of lean on Ben for advice. But what I've read so far, basically what you guys have basically said as well, it's, you know, the top seeds for sure, and I think even the number two seeds in any of the brackets there that might have a chance to push on through to the Final Four as well. But what do I know? So rely on Ben and Patrice.
Than you do about college basketball, so we'll move on to some Champions League action that happened today. A little bit of a surprise, I guess, with one of the European giants, Inter Milan, winning, but not moving on to the next round.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to watch the game because I didn't get that on my TV. I was actually watching the 7-0 trouncing of Basel and Bayern Munich, but yeah, it's what happened in the game? Is it tied on aggregate?
Inter went out 2-1 on aggregate, actually.
Yeah.
They won, okay.
Inter lost today.
Actually. Oh, they lost, sorry.
They lost.
But they had won and then lost on aggregate.
So
on away goals, yeah. That's it, okay, yeah, away goals. So Marseille actually advanced.
Yeah.
So,
but Inter's been dire this year. I mean, like, you know, you're seeing it all over Europe. You're seeing older teams with new managers that are basically rebelling because the managers are trying to freshen up the team and play in a different way, and the old guard's just basically saying, we're not having it, it's not happening. And, you know, You're seeing it at Chelsea. You're seeing it at, you're seeing it with Inter. You know, I mean, like, Inter is just an old team. And Marseille is a vibrant young team that, you know, plays the right way. They want to attack. They understand they have to defend. But they put the pressure on for 90 minutes. And Inter just wants to, you know, pass the ball between its center backs and its keeper for 90% of the game.
Well, one thing's for sure, it's not the typical heavyweights that are making it through the knockout stage into the quarterfinals, into the semis. It's some smaller teams that are doing the damage. And for the first time ever, depending on what happens tomorrow with Chelsea and Napoli, you may not have an English Premier League in the semis. So definitely some shocking results. I mean, even the other one, Real Madrid and CSKA Moscow are tied 1-1 in aggregate. So I think there's no doubt Real Madrid will go through, but... You know, seeing some of these smaller teams to get this far is definitely surprising to me.
Well, look at Applewell. They're like a team from Cyprus.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they're through to the next round. They won their game, I think it was last week, I guess, was the last game. So it's good for the Champions League, though. It's good that, you know, the established teams don't go through all the time. I mean, you know, I'm a Manchester United fan through and through, and it really hurts me to see them in the Europa League. But, you know, until today, I thought Basel was full value for, you know, getting through the group until they just got destroyed today.
Yeah, that's an understatement of destroy. Mario Gomez with 4 goals. So, you know, last week you had Messi with 5. So some definitely some big performances in some of these games. Ben, your thoughts?
Well, I think it's just fun to see more and more goals. Like you saw the 7 goals by Bayern today. So I think it's fun to see some of the superstars play, and the attacking soccer is more fun to watch. Now, as a Spurs fan, I don't feel anywhere as about seeing United in the Europa League, but I'm crossing my fingers that we're going to be in Champions League next year.
Are Spurs even still in Europe? Like, I mean, are they playing in the Europa League? Like, what do they do when European games come on? Like, you know, watch the games in Spurs Lounge or in the pub. Like, I mean, come on.
Taking some friendly knocks against each other. I know, Patrice, that you mentioned before we start recording here is about the other result with Liverpool, defeating Everton. You're kind of saying my team. Ben and I talked about this on the podcast. The whole thing about Suarez has basically soured me on Liverpool. So I'm not cheering for Liverpool.
Give him a chance to rant.
If I start ranting on Suarez, I'm sure the podcast is probably going to go till tomorrow. So. I'll leave that in the path where it belongs, but suffice it to say that I'll just say Suarez is a nasty piece of business, to leave it at that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the only good thing about seeing Liverpool win today was Gerrard getting a hat trick, and he's been there for a long time. He's obviously getting older. He's coming on as a sub now, but having him still go out there and prove that he's still capable of playing, I still like him as a player, but as long as Suarez is there, I'm not going to be cheering for Liverpool.
I mean, all I gotta say about Stevie Mee is that he's had an injury disrupt the season, but hopefully, you know, it looks good for England because he hasn't played a lot, so he should be fresh come Euro 2012.
Yeah, definitely hoping. Which is the English team is basically a mess. We'll get into another podcast, but now, of course, Patrice, you're a huge fan of WrestleMania, so 19 days away. And I don't watch much wrestling. I know you guys watch way more than I do. So what matches are you looking forward to?
Well, obviously everyone's looking forward to the return of the great one to his hometown against John Cena. But that's not the match I'm looking forward to. I'm actually looking forward to CM Punk versus Chris Jericho, which I believe is going to be the match of the night. Because you have two guys who are technically probably two of the top wrestlers wrestling right now. They tell a fantastic story. They're both fantastic on the mic. They're fantastic in the ring. And that match is the match that I believe will steal the show. I mean, with The Rock and Cena, like, I mean, to me it's like The Rock against Hulk Hogan. Because Cena has, like, 4 moves. And you know you're going to do that anyways. The only question I have is, how is the finish going to go? Because if the internet is to be believed, those two guys have a genuine dislike for each other. And I can't see The Rock putting Cena over in his hometown in a clean win. So, that being said, The Rock is leaving to film like 3 or 4 movies after, so it makes no sense for the WWE to have like the face of the company lose cleanly to the guy he's been running down and then come back on Monday Night Raw the next day and, like, you know, have to put up with, you know, the, you know, I mean, he gets booed out of most of the arenas he's in anyways. So, you know, I'm just interested to see how that match is going to end. But Punk and Jericho is going to be the best match of WrestleMania.
It almost seems like this Cena-Rock feud has been dragging on for literally since last WrestleMania, when I think it got announced like a day after the last one that was going to be the main event for the next one. And, you know, every Monday night they've been on Raw, jawing back and forth at each other, and now it's just to the point where I don't even know if I want to care about this match anymore. Like, I love The Rock. Like, he's probably one of my favorite all-time wrestlers just because he's so charismatic, but this is just, it's almost gone above and beyond now, and I'm almost getting tired of it. The one that I want to see just for, memories, Undertaker versus Triple H, Hell in a Cell, referee Shawn Michaels. Like, this is like, even when I was growing up, these guys were the wrestlers, and now they're still here. I guess Undertaker still has his unbeaten streak going on. I don't even know why Triple H is still wrestling. Shawn Michaels, you know he's going to interfere some way, but he's going to do something crazy and outlandish. I think it's going to be cool. You know, those guys, no matter how old they get and how slow they get and how fewer moves they have, they still put on a great match somehow. So I'm kind of looking forward to that one for some strange reason.
Well, as for me, I'm not really looking forward to anything. I'm probably not going to watch it, but glad to have your insights there. Anything else you'd like to add, Ben, Patrice, on the whole show?
You know, but once again, guys, it's a pleasure to, thanks again for having me on. It's always a good time, you know, get to exchange some opinion with some like-minded sports fans. And so, once again, thanks for having me on, and I'm looking forward to the next time.
Glad to have you back on, Ben.
And you can follow Patrice on Twitter at TallTeach33. I'm sure he'll appreciate the followers and then not accept you as a follower.
Probably.
but as always, you can connect with the 500 Level Podcast on Twitter at 500_level_pod. We'd love to hear from you. Give us your opinion. Maybe we'll use one of your questions next time in the podcast. But until next time, looking down on you from the 500 level.